Hey, fearless fundraisers, I'm Donna Leko, and it's time to buckle up for a new episode of Raise Nation Radio, the one and only podcast made to inspire fundraisers like you to continue making impact in our communities, building better tomorrows, and exchanging ideas. So whether you're a trailblazer or seasoned pro, you'll pick up the trends that transform your fundraising. And together, we'll dive into lively conversations and chat with industry-leading fundraisers and thought leaders to explore hot-button issues and innovative ideas. So stay with us for the next 30 minutes while we inspire you to embrace the future of fundraising. Well, Raise Nation Radio, welcome back. I love this community because we so lift each other up every day. And today we have a very inspiring guest who's really who's opened some light for me, and I hope does the same for you. So please welcome to our show, Miss Angela Harrelson. Hi, Angela. I'm so glad that you're here. For those that are listening and think the name is familiar, it is. Angela Harrelson is the aunt to George Floyd. And I use the word lift because she is so incredibly uplifting. She did write a book, and I learned so much in the book. So I want all of Raise Nation Radio to just stop right now, go to Amazon or wherever you buy your books, lift your voice. How my nephew, George Floyd's murder changed the world, which it did. And we're going to get into that. I got the opportunity to read the book a couple weeks ago. I learned a lot. Angela, thank you, thank you, thank you. But before we get into it, we all know what we know of you from social media and the news, which I don't know how accurate that is all the time. So why don't you introduce yourself to our audience, share whatever you'd like about yourself personally, what you're doing today, and how you're doing, because we would love to know and hear from you.
Well, thank you. You know, like you said, I'm Angela Harrelson. I'm the maternal aunt, George Floyd. You know, George Floyd's mother and I are sisters. That's the
sissy.
Yeah, sissy.
Yeah.
We call him Perry. The world knows him as George Floyd, but we just know him as just Perry. We've always called him. From a family of 14, my mom had 10 girls and 4 boys. And you know it. We was really raised up. We come from a very, very humbling beginnings. And I moved to Minneapolis 1998, so I've been there quite a while. But my nephew moved in 2017, you know, and so it was life-changing events for both of us. He came here with a change, I came in with a change, you know, and change has pretty much brought us together as a family. And unfortunately, things happen out of my control, and we're here, and we're here, Don. And but through that time, the death of my nephew, I kind of jumped a little ahead. I have accepted being in a position of the George Floyd Global Memorial. I'm a co-chair of that. I do a lot of community work. Boots on the ground. I still do boots on the ground out there with the community, helping, supporting them out there, you know. And I sit and I've learned so much about people. And, you know, I didn't realize I could do all of these things. And people always saying, how do you do this? It definitely came from within, a voice that came within. So, it's just so much. It was so much that I took on. I didn't know I could do it, but I got the strength to do it.
Talk about an incredible, amazing woman. I think it started there. But, you know, you have a rich history, too. You're a captain in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
You're a nurse. And you really, I think, had all of the foundational qualities to accept this role in your family. So do you want to share a little bit about what you do in the medical world and your journey in the military? And by the way, thank you so much. I mean, we're so indebted to you for so many reasons. One being the voice of change and your service as well. So you are a captain in the Air Force, isn't that true?
Yes, No, my mother was still took on how I achieved all these things because we didn't, we grew up poor. My parents were sharecroppers. My parents did not have a high school education. So her only goal for me was to graduate from high school because because she never got to graduate from high school. And so, but people ask, well, how did you do all these things? I said, because I watched the struggle. I watched the perseverance. My mother constantly taught us, you can do this with hard work. Even though we didn't have much money, we had the love that was there, which makes a difference in families. You know, you can be poor and not have anything, you know, but if you don't have that love and support within the family, you know, things can go sideways. But I always knew my mom cared. We were young in the field where we probably shouldn't have been working in the fields.
Yeah, really.
I'm going to be honest. But we worked alongside my mom in the tobacco field. We had an outhouse. We used a well, very little electricity. And so I just learned through that struggle, just keep going. And that's how I did it. Was it easy for me? No, it wasn't easy for me. You know, I went through the racism. Trying to go to nursing school, trying to in the military. It was all there. I just kept going because I knew, no, if I keep going, somebody would finally say, yeah. Did it make me cry? Did I get frustrated? I did. Yeah, I did. There have been times when that teacher told me, and I was so happy, that professor, you know, of a college, and I still remember his name. I won't say his name. I don't know if he's even living now. I do not teach. I do not teach Black people. I was trying.
I want to cry. I read that.
He said, "I am racist," and he wanted me to know that it was after class. And I remember the course. The course was called Bankruptcy Law. I was so excited, you know, because I have a chance. I moved away from home. This is a chance, and I was intimidated because the intimidation of being raised up in down south. To take a very passive role. You always respect white people. My mother told me that you don't question them. And, you know, and my mother was teaching us stuff out of fear because you remember croppers. So if we make the farmers mad, we have to leave, move out of the house. And she didn't have any money and my father didn't have anything either. So growing up at those times, we were very careful. So, but I still remember that intimidation. So that carried with me. And when he said that, I was intimidated by his presence, by the white superiority. Okay, I better not do this. You know, it didn't matter if it was wrong or right. I knew that I should not be in that class. So how do I get past it? You know, I do what you call silent resiliency. Meaning I keep my mouth shut, but as long as I had my mind and my heart, I can keep going because that's what my mom taught me.
Well, you are remarkably resilient, but I think we're grateful now that it's not silent resiliency. Right. Yeah, because we need your voice.
Yeah.
For sure. Heartbreaking, really. It is, but to see you prevail just so fills me up with hope and hopefully fills you and your family up with pride.
It does. I mean, but back then people say, why did you be quiet? You had to get what you, but it doesn't mean that your dreams were gone. You just had to find another.
Of course not. Yeah, so, but you're finding your way.
Yeah, find my way, but I learned to use my voice. But when my nephew was killed, I'm like, you know what? It was on. I'm using my voice. I'm going to say what I have to say because enough is enough.
For sure. So let's talk about Perry. May I call him Perry? Is that okay? Perry. So I only knew what I know of Perry from social media and the news. Which I mentioned earlier, I don't know if I should rely on that so much anymore. So I'm going to come and ask you, can you share some memories or aspects of Perry and what you want the public to know? Not the news and social media version. What do you want? What do we need to know? What do you want us to know about Perry?
you know, there was a lot of stuff out of some stuff like he did what, you know, but, you know, he wasn't perfect. And I always have to say it could be
crazy. Hey, guess what? Neither am I. I don't know anybody who's perfect, except maybe my dad, but.
But, you know, we as a family, we've never said that he was perfect. We never said he didn't go to jail. We never said that he never served prison, that he wasn't. But we never said those things. You know, he made some bad decisions in his past, you know, but he just did not deserve to die the way he did. And I'll always say that. But Perry, what I wanted people to know, his humbleness comes from his beginnings. And one of our memories, Perry, like when he was 4 years old growing up, you know, my sister often came to live with us. So Perry, his two sisters, we all came to live with us, you know. And I did not never understand the life. I mean, why do they keep coming here? They move away to stay in these apartments and things, and they come back to a place where they have to put water.
And use outhouses, right? So he went from apartment life to an outhouse life. Yeah.
It was the love when I look back on it, the food that we had, you know. But, you know, Perry, you know, he wasn't used to that. And I remember him there trying to learn how to cook. And then we started talking about water. And he's like, look at me, how you do this. But you know what? He didn't cry at anything. And so we didn't show him where the outhouse is and all that stuff my sister did. He didn't, for some reason, it didn't bother him. He didn't cry. I said, okay, I'm doing it. But because my sister had taught him. And so he was adventurous. He just fell in. And I was just amazed by that being, you know, because we're 12 years of difference, 16. Like I'm used to people coming around us, looking down on us, being poor. And so, wow, that was really nice to see. And so sometimes we had to watch Perry. And while we were the cheerleader. So we were mama and raised money. I mean, work really hard to save money for us to be part of the cheerleader squad. And so we did that, you know, and Perry was there. And the funny thing about it, I didn't know he was watching us because we were supposed to be kind of like, you know, watching my sister kids. But, you know, I tell you something about that. When he first moved back, that's the first thing he mentioned to me. He said, Angela, he said, I saw y'all cheerleader practicing. You know, we were supposed to be babies. And you really saw us chilling to practice. He said, yeah. He said, oh, y'all were really good. What do you want? It was so funny when he remembered that. So young, we back there chilling to practicing and all that stuff. And that was like really touched because I didn't know he was aware of that because he was so young.
And thank you for humanizing him. You know, I mean, it sounds like typical, regular, sneaking on his cousins, watching cheerleading practice. Brilliant, right? Not complaining about anything. He had running water, then no running water. And he's like, okay, I got this.
Yeah, he sure did. But one of the special things was that when he got out of prison, he went home. And my sister, and that he took my sister to church. My sister was in a wheelchair at that time because she had a major stroke. And the one precious thing, and she said, hey, Anthony, oh, going to church. He took her to church. And that was really.
Sissy had a stroke and was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And George took her to church
on Sunday. And she was so thankful.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He sure did. You know, he had a lot of regrets, you know. He did things he was proud of, but he wasn't raised that way. I think he lost hope within himself and tried to find a quick way to sell drugs, to do this, and it just led to some bad decisions, you know. And he did realize that, and he did try to do community work in Houston. I hear about the community work. For the black young teens and working with pastors. And he tried to do a lot of work to combat what he did. And his goal in Minneapolis was to do that.
Yeah.
To do that.
Yeah, I believe that. You see that love that just rippled through him and the upbringing and the resilience. And, you know, hey, lots of people make bad decisions, and you know, Perry paid his time.
He had
nothing to do with that. You know, what happened was just horrific. And oh God, I love learning about this side of Perry. Now you have a tight knit family, and you made promises to Sissy, right, to uphold and honor George's memory and to continue or to start a legacy. So can you share, there's a memorial. How has the memorial and the work that you're doing, how do you feel that it's impacted communities, especially those communities that are really affected by racial injustice and such brutality by the police? Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, I think for me, let's start with the memorial. The memorial there has become a solidarity. It has become a main focus point. I was writing those, a symbol, you know, for the community. And it is a constant reminder to them of what happened, but it's also a reminder to them why they need to fight, why we need to keep going, and why we need to do this. And it's also, it has become a sacred place. There's a lot of community engagement that takes place around the memorial, about the memorial. The community, bless their souls, they have meetings twice a day, right across from the memorial, talking about plans and strategies, and talking about their some of the demands they made with the city, what to do. We sometimes meet with people to help in building a community. What can we do to heal the community? They've been doing that for the last 4 years. They consider themselves still in protest. So the community engagement is very powerful, but not just for the community, it's also for the people that come there from all around the world. It's a catalyst for change, because people come there. Yes, they come there to pay respect. Yes, they come there to offer a sacred offering there. They come there, but once they leave, a lot of them are inspired to go back to their community to lift their voice.
Mm-hmm. Just like the book says.
Just like the book says, that memorial also offered a place for healing, you know.
And reflection.
For reflection, and the time to just sit. And so many, like yesterday, I was out there at the George Ford Square, and one of the community members was riding a bicycle. He said, "Good morning, George." He kept right on going.
Oh, so sweet.
And that just hit me. Oh, Don, that just hit me. And it just made me realize how connected. I didn't want to cry. It just made me realize the connection there is so strong that he was riding his back. And then it's Ray, by the way. I know him pretty well. But he didn't know I was there. I go, I had my back turned to talk. I was talking to other people. He said, "Good morning, George." You know what I'm saying? And it just shows the connection and the ties there.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you visit often, and I think that just about every time you visit, there's a poignant moment, right? There's a connection, as you're saying. We're really feeling the connection and the need to lift each other up. And I love that it's serving as a place where people could reflect on themselves, how they can show up better and differently and fight any type of racial injustice and bring it back to their communities. I mean, that's really what George Floyd Square is doing today for the community.
Education awareness in our work, George Floyd Globe Memorial, we just integrate all of that, you know, with them, because, you know, our foundation, it's called the George Floyd Globe Memorial. We are an art institute, and we collect. We have been, over the last 4 years, collecting offerings. The community members do too. And we're in the preservation conservation work. And so we're able to, you know, have conserved stories that have been, you know, conserve these stories, you know, and conserve these stories through artwork.
You're planning on a museum with this artwork, right?
Yes, you know, which is going slowly, but we hope to get something launched in 2025. But all of these artwork that we collect and preserve are voices of the unheard.
Yeah.
Voices of the unheard. They all tell a story. They all tell a very powerful story. And we get a chance to do exhibits with these things, with these artwork. People are fascinated with this. They want us to bring a piece of the George Floyd Square to their communities to continue to tell the story. We recently have artwork on exhibits in Phoenix, Arizona, at Arizona State University, in their museum. And it's far powerful. They even have our big, I think about 12-foot, almost 12-foot fence.
All right,
their museum.
So there's more than one fist?
Yeah, we have five fists.
Oh, you do? I know.
Right in the center, 38 in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Have one in each intersection.
Okay. And is the intersection, did it close off again? Is it now preserved? Because I think they wanted to open it up at one point and maybe did, but it kind of like disrupted the square.
Well, it did, but you know how the community was, they came back to solidarity. So, okay, you know.
Good.
Break the open, but you won't break her. It just makes her. And so we feel strong. We still do the community meeting. And guess what? People, what it did, you know, it just made more people come.
That worked.
It made more people come.
Yeah. What did you say? You know, it doesn't break us. It makes us. I love that.
Yeah, it made more people come.
More people come. Good, 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 good. So what do you hope that everything that you're doing, preserving Perry's legacy, do you think it's going to positively influence the future generations like we hope it does?
I do think so. I think that when this happened to my nephew, it was a great awakening to America, but it was a sleeping giant to the brown and black folk. You know, I always say that, what sleeping giant without? And I think this young generation gets it. They don't have that fear, hesitancy, like we did. You know, in the past, when the grassroots, people have been protesting and doing civil rights marching for a long time, you know, but we didn't have the support, the huge support like we did with George Floyd. Because remember, a lot of these people came out with either all black folks. We hardly saw white people at these places. But when my nephew was killed, he saw everybody. Everybody. I saw people in wheelchairs, all type of races. You know, I always used to tell someone, anything that memorial, people in wheelchairs come. People deaf, hard and hearing come. You know, I couldn't understand their sign language, you know, what they were trying to say. I couldn't understand everything, but I understood the love there. And they would write down and show me, and I got it. I said, I hear you. I feel you. I got it. And we were together. And that's how powerful it is. And so with that message, that change, there is so much hope for the future. You know, you got people, the social awareness, that people are talking, corporations, institutions that open their hearts up for change, put in educational programs about bias and DEI, and willing to have the awareness to educate. That is so powerful, because I know how many years I had to keep my mouth shut, to keep my job, to try to do a career advancement. And to be able to have this conversation with you is powerful, because I was raised up in the 60s. I wasn't able to do that.
Gosh, I couldn't wait to talk to you today. I guess I'm somewhat grateful for the hope that I'm hearing you talk about for future generations and what Perry's legacy, let's call it George Floyd so everybody knows who we're talking about, what George's murder is doing for us. There is something coming out of that, and that, I guess, is something to be grateful for in some way.
Yeah, because people say, well, you know, Angela, some people you hear say, well, nothing has changed. A lot has changed. Now, are we there yet?
No. Yeah. Long way to go.
Setbacks. Yeah, we're going to have setbacks. There are going to be, you're going to hear more killings, unfortunately. But here's the thing. We may have setbacks, but we're going to have frequent comebacks.
You are just pulling out these quotes. I think you need to have another book. Just with Dr. Angela Harrison quote. right? They're not going to break us. They're going to make us. We'll have setbacks, but we'll have quicker comebacks. I'm like, yeah, we need a quote book from you. So how has the George Floyd Square come to life? I mean, it's really moving. It's an experience. This is not just like, this is an experience when you're there, huh?
You have to experience, you know. It has created a life of its own. And no one could have planned anything, how the community would respond, how they would act or react or respond. It's an experience. You have got to be there. You can hear about it, but you have got to experience, you know, how the community painted the beautiful murals all over the square, and how they can look at something that needs to, like the memorial, they volunteers, they come out there, they sweep up the memorial, they keep it tidying up. Kind of predicted that, you know, we have so many volunteers, like they'll come out there and do things, they'll light candles. You go out there one evening, candles are lit up at the memorial, you know.
Now you're coming up on an anniversary, right? May 25th, yeah.
Yeah,
what's being planned?
Well, this year we're going to, the last 3 years have been really heavy, really intense. I think this year we're going to do like a special kind of like vigil that we're looking at doing, maybe including like a Helen Hill there, but we're going to do much stronger, a more bigger one on the fifth year. So everyone's
next year.
Yeah, the fifth year, we want to do like a much bigger one there because we're already starting getting inquiries about the fifth year. You know, and the media, but the fifth, because we have had some really incredible last 3 years. I mean,
I better put this on my calendar. Maybe that's the year I'll come visit.
A lot of volunteers and helped us throughout the years. And so we're just going to do a little break, but we're going to do something really special. Kind of like, so.
I mean, this is not individual led, it's community led, and it's really
38 in Chicago.
38. Yeah, it's all about. Yeah. So you mentioned before that you believe that we've made great progress with awareness. It's true. But also, you know, there's been changes for racial equality. Can you share with me what is changing? What do you feel has been the progress since Perry's death?
Well, you know, like, for example, like, let's give like some the healthcare initiative, things like in the healthcare, you know. Even in the hiring practice, different. When they hiring practice, they look at diversity, and I've seen the hiring practices where they try to make sure it's like, you know, with the hiring practice, they looked at the healthcare initiative to see, like in medicine, especially in maternal care, there is it was brought to my attention. I wasn't aware of the disparity of the care that was given to Black patients and the healthcare than the white patient, you know. And they're looking at these disparities. Why is there a disparity? Why is this still going on, you know? And so they're looking at that. And not just that, it's like institutions, corporations have put in programs. I have never seen so many DEI programs in colleges. They're talking about it. And, you know, and it's just because at my job that I work at, we didn't have a DEI program. It wasn't there, but it was there that George Floyd took place.
Let's talk about your book a little. So it was almost 2 years after Perry's murder, and it's a beautiful book. I love the cover. I love the title. I love everything about it. I read it. We were chatting before we started this episode, and I told you I read it in one sitting. It's a great read. If you're out there, please pick up Angela's voice. Angela's book, Lift Your Voice. But I'm curious, what inspired you to write a book? How long did it take? Can you share the significance behind the title? I think I know what you're going to say there. What does it symbolize? And I think I'd love to know, like, was there any healing for you when you wrote the book?
You know, actually, what started this process, you know, when I finally came out of my shell and going through this whole chaos, you know, people would interview me, and when I would interview, I was always tell stories about my family. You know, I've always, maybe it's the auntie in me, just with about Perry, because I wanted people to know about his family, that we're not all these bad people that they say, yeah, you know, do we have bad people family? Yeah, But we are people that, you know, just like any other Black family, going through systemic racism all our lives and stuff, you know? And I wanted people to know some good things about our family, that we do try. We do try to do the best that we can. We're not a family. And so they would hear me talk about all these different things. And they said, you know, you really should write a book. You know, they would put me plant these seeds. So we love your story that you tell us. And so I would always tell stories that way. And then I remember writing stuff down in journal to help me deal with it. Because, you know, everybody in my family was going through. So I really didn't have people to talk to. I had my family to talk to, but we were all talking. We're all talking the same grief, the same pain. And, you know, everyone, you know, and I said, you know what? And we were putting burdens on one another and didn't realize it. You know, we were just trying to do the best we can as a family. And so I started writing and journaling and putting things down. So actually the journal became the book, and I was happy to meet people and talk out to people. People reached to me and I reached back out to them by the book, and everything just connected. So I was able to put my stories and everything I experienced at the time in the book. Now, was it healing for me? Towards the end, it became more healing for me. In the beginning, it was frustrating. Like when I made the commitment, it was like, well, no, if I'm ever going to finish this. Because remember, I'm going through a trial. I'm going through the courtroom. I'm looking at Mr. Chauvin. I have to see him. You know, I have to defend his action. And then at the same time, my family is getting death threats. You know, I'm getting harassing phone calls. We're going through, I'm being followed. There were times I was being followed. One time me and my niece, we thought someone was going to run us off the road. It was awful. So these are things that we was going through trying to grieve.
Playbook for how to deal with any of this.
I never knew how to deal with any of this stuff. So it was just a hit and miss. And so there was some time I got frustrated. I don't want to make this book. You know, no one's going to read it. I'm just quitting. And then I started remembering. And God started, then I thought about when I go to the protest and go out, when I go to the court, see all the people out there, you know, sending the love with us. And I would get letters and I would look on the news and see the protest. And then it all would come back on me, Don. Then I'm like, look at all that love and support. I can do this. So you know what? Love took me to the finish line. So I was able to finish the book.
There's another quote. Love took me to the finish line. I'm telling you, I see a sequel to the book with all of you.
Took me to the finish line.
Yeah, it's a great book. I really enjoyed reading. I think I enjoyed reading it so much. Not that I enjoyed it, because it's a hard read too. I mean, you know, it's just like it gets you every once in a while, you know, brings tears to your eyes. But there's some hope in it, right? And you're so positive and you're really looking for the future and protecting, you know, Perry's legacy. And you've risen to a place in your family where I think everybody rallies around you for the bigger Angela, for the bigger family, for the bigger community, for the greater of all of us. And I'm sorry that it came out the way it did, but you know, at the same time, there's hope there. I somewhat empathize. I would never put this on the same scale, but I have a cousin who was, his life was taken in a hate crime. And just any kind of racism is just not good and should never, gosh, end in murder. And the fact that you can take it and turn it into something is remarkable.
You have to, though, because you can be, you can't be a voice where you can you have hate, you know, towards people. You know, you can't fight love. You can't fight hate. This thing with hate, you can only fight it with love. You know, and I know this sounds kind of cliche, but it's true, because it will swallow you. It will eat you away. No, but, you know, I was in a very dark place. I did not know what to do. And I always tell this story. And because when he was first killed, every day I woke up, I thought about it. You go to bed dreaming of it. It was I said, God,
constantly. Yeah.
I'm not going to be a voice for him. But what God showed me, he said, Angela, if I can give Perry the courage and the strength to say the words, can't breathe. If I can give him this strength to say those words, I can't breathe. In those conditions, when he was in pain, when he was desperate, when he was distraught, we going through that, surely I can give you the strength to be a voice for him. And when that came to me, that's what I went for, because it was the truth. And that's what drove me. He said, I can't breathe 27 times before he passed away. 27 times. But it takes a lot. And working as a nurse, when you're in pain, it takes a lot of courage to say you can't breathe. Yeah, there's a courage and a bravery component and having enough strength to get that out to say, I need help. But he looked to Mr. Chauvin for that. You don't say I need help to monster. But there was a period where he looked at him as a human being. I'm telling you, I need help. Other word, can't breathe. But Mr. Chauvin couldn't see that. And that was sad to me.
Yeah. And it really shows just the humility and the character of Perry, because he was asking his murderer for help. And that alone is, you know, there's just no resentment or bitterness or anger or hate within your family. There really is so much love. And I think Perry showed that in that moment too.
He did. And I think sometimes people, you know, and I just want to point that out, because you have to remember, you know, even if you're kidnapped, you look for help. But there's a moment there. Do they have a humanity? Is the humanity there? Because you're going to reach for that. You hope it might be 10%. It might be 5%. But that momentary, you see that. It's just that Mr. Chauvin didn't have enough to see it in Perry.
But Perry still believed in humanity in that moment. I'd want to address something in the book. I'm hoping you could help me understand a little bit better. You talk about two different terms, and maybe you can clarify it for me and for the audience, non-racism and anti-racism in the book. Can you elaborate on the difference for our audience? Because that's very poignant, right? There is a difference. And I'd love for you to elaborate on that a little bit more.
Well, there's a difference. I guess the easy way I can explain you, the people who are anti-race, they're going to stand up. They're going to use their voice. You're going to hear about them. You know, they're about not making that change, but holding someone accountable and making a difference. They're about, you know, the people who are non-racist, you know, and they're very passive, you know, meaning like if they see something is wrong, as long as they're okay, they're just going to look the other way. For example, it could be like, you know, they would they may be the people who would never participate in hate crimes or anything, but they would sit at the dinner with racism and hear them say the word N-word and talk about, let's look at them. They'll do all of that, but they don't take an active role in saying, you know what? Don't say that. That is not me. You know what? You know, we're all created equal. They won't say that because it's not them. And, you know, and that saddens me, because they miss a teachable moment. They also miss the moment of transforming into personal growth, not just for them, but for the people who they're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the best way I can explain that. And I think before George Floyd, there was a lot of non-race people, you know. And just because you know a race doesn't mean they're bad people. I want to make that clear. It's just they're at a comfort level and they allow stuff to happen.
Passively.
And they don't realize that their voice is so powerful, and that if you're silent and you don't say something, and in your gut tells you, you know, that's not right, but you just let it pass. It could be the same thing at work. It happens all the time. A person gets in trouble at work. You know the supervisor was wrong, but as long as it's not happening to you, as long as you get your paycheck, you're good to go. And you know, for humanity, that is not okay. why can't you at least go in and talk to the supervisor and be a voice? Because if you, what is stopping you? See, and that goes on, but now we live in a society now that your voice is so important. It is okay, it's much better now to stand up.
Stand up and speak up.
Yeah, now it's more accepted now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by that. A more of a passive role.
Yeah, that was another light bulb moment. The being an active listener instead of being like a passive listener, I got that out of the book. And I appreciate the distinction between non-racism and anti-racism.
We have a ways to go, you know. But you remember, this racism is, you're not born a racist, you're taught.
I mean, you know, the younger generations, you can't blame them. You can only try to show them a different way.
We have come a long way. You know, remember Martin Luther King, in his speech, I Have a Dream, he said that it'd be one day, don't quote me, that one day black and white children would be able to hold hands. You know, don't quote me on that. But today, black and white people are married. They have kids together. Who would have thought? You know, it was illegal to marry a person outside your race. You know, it was illegal. People would go to, in some states, you would go to prison for that.
Love will find a way. Love is
going
to get us there.
And you keep pushing it and you get through. We will get there. You know, the goal is not to hold a sign that says Black Lives Matter, you know.
Oh, you have a lot to say about that in your book, too.
But, you know, we have to get to a place where in this big, beautiful world that we don't have to hold a sign that say Black Lives Matter. We know we matter. That's when you know you have arrived when you do that. But now we do it because we have to do that. We want people to know that we hold that sign because we mean something and that we matter. We're not saying that white folks don't matter. We're not saying, and I think they get mixed up. Some people get mixed up with that. Well, we matter too. We matter. It wasn't out there because this is what people don't understand. For so long, you know, we had equality was an option for. You know, when I say that, we had to negotiate equality. That's basically what we're doing. We're trying to get laws and policies, but is negotiate equality. Why should we be doing that? Negotiating to ride the bus, negotiating to vote. Those things weren't approved to us. So, you know, if people go back in history, this is why we say we matter. Because we had to negotiate equality almost all our life. I was one of those people that couldn't ride the school bus.
One of your young peers stood up for you on that school bus, didn't she?
And she was white. And that's why her voice made a difference. Her voice is what changed that. Her voice. Because she was white, they listened. That's why I tell people that voice didn't make a difference. Keep using your voice.
Have to use our voice. We can't be passive. We can't be non-racism. We have to be anti-racism. Yeah. Show up, stand up, speak up. So if people are listening and they're moved, as I've been moved ever since I read your book and through this podcast, what do you need? How can listeners get involved?
Oh, my goodness, you beautiful audience, if you listen, go to georgefloydglobalmemorial.org. Go there. You can donate, support us. Oh, we love you. We're trying to do what we are doing great things. We want to get a permanent memorial launch. We want to expand to other resources to help our community. We need to rebuild our community. We need actually resources for the community heal. We would love to get offices and buildings and stuff to help expand to help the community. It's all about the community with healing. But most of all, right now, our main goal is to get a
Got it. So I'm going to put all of this in our show notes. So for our audience that's listening, I'll link the George Floyd Global Memorial and Angela's book and all the things. So no, you don't have to go Googling or do anything difficult. they can just go to these show notes and I'm going to put it all there and we're going to get it out. But before I let you go, I want to ask you one more question. What words of encouragement or hope would you offer to those who continue to either suffer from or advocate for just racial justice and equality in our society, for those who are anti-racist, they want to stand up, they want to speak up? What words of encouragement would you give them?
I have to say this, you know, it's some of the hardest work that you would ever do, but it's also the most rewarding work that you do. And just remember that you don't need everybody. You need the right people. So if only two people show up, that's okay. The right people will. Because sometimes we do this activism work, we got to have 20 people. We got to have 100. We got to go. We got to put faith. No, all you need is the right people. Just the right people. And you take that and you run with it and let everything else fall in place.
Wow. And I'm grateful that you've been surrounded with the right people. I know those that helped you write the book and the community that has uplifted you with George Floyd Square.
You just got to open that door and reach out, you know. And, you know, and like I said, you may not start with everybody. Everyone that you extend your hand to may not extend your hand. But if you keep doing it, the right people will show up. They always do.
Yeah.
Always.
Everything, the universe aligns sometime.
So I talked to an uncle the other day. I talked to a cousin the other day. I talked to a sister about a few weeks ago. But for the most part, I think as a whole, we're doing okay. I don't know all the details. I know that people are still grieving in their own way.
They'll be grieving, I'm sure.
Yeah, and one thing I learned, you cannot put a expiration date on grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no start time and no expiration date. And I've learned that through this whole process because it can come out sideways. You can start crying instantly. You don't even know why. And so we all knew Perry differently, so we all are going to grieve differently. So there was nothing normal about this whole process.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's with us now. I feel his energy and his presence. And he's probably saying, Auntie, good job. Good job. So we got it right today. I think we're sending a message. We're telling the community and helping them understand to embrace us. And we did good today.
Yeah, we did.
Thank you for the guidance. Well, Fearless Fundraisers, that's about all we have time for today. Hopefully you were as inspired as I am by Dr. Angela Harrelson. Please get her book. It's one for your bookshelves. Lift Your Voice, How My Nephew George Floyd's Murder Changed the World. And indeed, it did. I'm so grateful to our audience for listening. And I do hope everybody enjoyed today's message and took something away from it and feel uplifted as Angela intended. Please tune in for a new episode release every Thursday at 12:30 p.m. That's Thursdays, 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. But in the meantime, you can listen to all the shows on Raise Nation Radio, and you can just follow us on whatever channel you like best because we stream everywhere. We are on 10 different channels. We're on demand at onecause.com, and you can find us live at industry events and at the annual Raise Conference. A huge shout out and thanks to my guest and my, hopefully I can call friend now, Angela Harrelson, George Floyd's aunt, just for sharing such heartwarming stories and lifting us up and teaching us a thing or two about how to show up better in this world for all people. Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And thank your audience for listening.
Well, thank you again, everyone. That is a wrap. Until next time, I'm Dawn Lego. This is Raise Nation Radio. You stay fearless out there.